Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Now, this is a series I've been sitting on for some time, and I'm delighted to launch it today. I've spent a great deal of my own time and professional career in China, working with some of the most wonderful people, uncovering some of the most wonderful maritime stories. So it's time for a few episodes on the maritime history of China. Today, we begin everything with Zheng He. If you're English, you might read his name as Zheng He, Z-E-N-G-H-E. But in Chinese, it's pronounced Zheng He. And what a fascinating man he was. A Ming Dynasty court eunuch, a diplomat, an explorer, a mariner, a Muslim. Zheng He lived from the 1370s to around 1433. And he did something really quite remarkable. Between 1405 and 1433, he commanded 7 expeditionary voyages, which came to be known as treasure voyages. And he explored the East China Sea, the South China Sea, went up through the Straits of Malacca to the Bay of Bengal, around India and Sri Lanka to the Arabian Sea, the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, and on to the east coast of Africa. And he did this with enormous ships in enormous fleets. A lot of this is still conjecture, but if you believe the sources, some of the ships were almost twice as long as any wooden ship ever recorded. On the first voyage, it's believed that there were no fewer than 265 ships in total, 62 of them being of the largest type, the treasure ships. Now, historians believe these largest vessels had 5 or 6 masts and were up to 300 feet long. But that is the most conservative of estimates. There's very little physical evidence to prove any of this, with the exception of one rudder, which is 36 feet long, a monstrous piece of timber that does suggest a ship of at least 300 feet in length. Zheng He's 7 voyages provide a fascinating foundation for historical debate and narrative. Here is an empire using sea power to reach out beyond its borders, a golden time of exploration, which does not last. The scale of the fleets, the distance of the voyages, and the activities of the Chinese when they're abroad are all very much unsettled in the minds of modern historians. To find out more, I spoke with the absolute best in the business, someone who is very careful about what to believe in the magnificent Zheng He story. Professor Tim Brook is a historian of China at the University of British Columbia. He's everything you want from a history professor, deeply knowledgeable, very entertaining, and of course, very suspicious. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoyed talking with him. Here's Tim. Tim, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
It's a great pleasure, Sam. Thank you for the invitation.
The big question, I think, with China and their wonderful explorations in the 15th century, is the kind of the mystery of when they started thinking about taking to the sea. Do we have a sense of when that happened?
I have a very clear sense of that as a historian of this period. Chinese have been getting into ships and sailing down the coastline of Southeast Asia for centuries before the big voyages. They were doing it largely for commercial purposes. So they would be smaller ships. They would perhaps have a couple of dozen crew on them, just small coastal trading. But when it changes is when the Mongols conquer China and during the period known as the Yuan Dynasty. And this has to do with the diplomatics of the East Asian world. When Kublai Khan conquers China, he brings to China the vision of imperial power that was forged by his ancestor, Genghis Khan. And when Kublai becomes the great Khan of all the Mongols, he needs to send out missions to the rest of the world to inform them that he is the greatest ruler in the world, he now rules, and that they should acknowledge him as the ruler that heaven has appointed to rule the world. And so it's under Kublai Khan that China first starts these large missions into the Indian Ocean. We don't hear about these. These have been completely forgotten because of the fascination that people started to have 30 years ago with the Zheng He voyages into the Indian Ocean. But they were already happening, and he was sending envoys to Ceylon to try and secure there's a famous Buddha statue there that he was trying to secure. He was trying to secure jewels, because the ruler who holds jewels are like this crystallization of heaven's power. And the more great jewels you have, the more you are able to attest to the fact that you are heaven's choice as the ruler of the world. And in fact, this is often forgotten, but Marco Polo gets back home to the Mediterranean on one of these voyages. And that particular voyage was to send a princess from China to Persia who was supposed to marry the Ilkhan. But the voyage takes over 2 years to travel the route around Southeast Asia and across India, because it's involved in all of these diplomatic negotiations mostly with coastal powers, to make sure that they acknowledge that the ruler of the Yuan Great State, which happens to be China at this period, is the heaven's appointed ruler of the world. So you've got China's experience on the ocean is at two levels. One, there's this sort of commercial level of smaller vessels that are trading around Southeast Asia into the Indian Ocean. And then you have the state stepping in and sending these larger diplomatic embassies, using, of course, the same technology that the commercial sailors had developed, using the same routes. They are simply the diplomatic voyages are simply tracing the routes that the commercial voyages had been working out for several centuries.
It's interesting that the Mongols, sorry to interrupt there, that the Mongols are the ones that take to the sea, because the Mongols are horsemen. They have no knowledge, they have no experience of it. So it I suppose it takes them a while.
Yes, and Genghis Khan had no particular notion of ever going to sea. But once Kublai Khan gets to the coast, he realizes, well, the world continues. And I, as heaven's choice of ruler of the world, need to make sure that the world is subject to my hegemony. So famously, he sends several fleets to Japan, and they are destroyed every time, by a combination of bad luck with the weather and Japanese resistance. So, and eventually Kublai has to sort of...
I think they just found an anchor from one of those fleets, have they not?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, yes, they have. There's been some great archaeology between the Korean Peninsula and Japan to recover some of the ships. And one of the interesting findings is that the Mongols threw together these fleets so quickly that they were sailing in kind of hulks that were ready to sink anyway. And it was a mess. They did not know how to organize a major ocean-going expedition. So after a couple of decades, Kublai just sort of looks the other way and says, well, we don't need to go to Japan. But he starts sending voyages down into Southeast Asia, to Java. He sends voyages into the Indian Ocean, not on the scale of the Zheng He voyages of the 15th century, but he's sending these ships as as diplomatic vessels.
You don't want to turn up on a diplomatic mission in a sinking ship, do you? Because that does no. shoot yourself in the no. foot.
No. And in fact, the history of Chinese shipbuilding is not as well developed as it could be. And the more wrecks we can find, the better we can understand that. But by the 15th century, they are building sizable, solid vessels that can travel all the way to the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, sort of big ocean-going junks. And I suppose it's important to point out that the history of Chinese seafaring tradition, they have a wonderful variety of ships which are designed for different types of coastal voyages in and around the estuaries. There's a difference between the north and the south. But the development of this sort of multi-masted ocean-going hulk is a kind of game changer, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. I'm not the person to answer questions about boat technology.
No, it's fine.
I simply admire it from a distance. What they can't do, or what they don't develop that early on, are ships that are maneuverable and quick. So they have these large vessels that they can put on the water, but they're not very maneuverable, and they're not particularly good in a case of a naval engagement.
So we've established that there's a kind of a prehistory to these diplomatic voyages during the Yuan dynasty. Then it all changes with Zheng He. How does it change? When does it change?
Well, I'm not sure how much we can say it changes with Zheng He. It changes after Zheng He is finished. We should remember that Zheng He was not a seaman. He was not. He's often called an admiral. The reason Zheng He is put in charge of these voyages is that he is a slave of the emperor's household. And the emperor does not want to put these voyages in the hands of the Chinese bureaucracy. He wants this to be under the control of the imperial household. So he chooses one of his castrated slaves. Zheng He is the man he chooses. And he chooses Zheng He because he's developed a relationship of trust with him. Also, Zheng He has proved himself to be a superb organizer. He's largely responsible for building the Forbidden City in Beijing at the beginning of the 15th century. And he does such a good job. Zheng He thinks he's the guy I'm sending to run these missions. As far as we know, Zheng He doesn't know anything about maritime issues. He's never been on a boat in his life until he steps aboard the first voyage that goes to the Indian Ocean. So he's not a seafarer. He's an organization man who is going to run, and it's a large organization because these fleets into the Indian Ocean, they're up to four dozen major vessels, and then that number, if not more, of smaller sort of accompanying pinnaces and so forth that accompanied the ship, up to 30,000 men on these expeditions. They were enormous. They were enormous operations, and Zheng He was the guy who could run an operation on this scale. And that's why he was also very imposing. He was over 6 feet tall and heavy set. And Emperor Yongle wanted a representative to go to rulers around Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean who was going to be an impressive sight. And Zheng fit that requirement very nicely.
Yeah, it's interesting that he was such a good administrator, because it's made me think of several maritime operations which were given to seamen who had no administrative experience, and they were all useless and they failed. I'm thinking of the Spanish Armada primarily, but there are other examples.
And the early history of the East India Company vessels, often the company appointed a seafarer to do the mechanics of the sailing, but then they appointed a merchant who understood commerce and logistics, and one would be superior to the other, but the two would have to work together to make these voyages work. We know so little about the personnel on the Zheng He voyages. We have a few memoirs that some people on those voyages wrote, but we really can't piece them together in the detail that we can the early European voyages, which is unfortunate. It would be interesting to know more. What's attracted my attention as a historian, though, is what this did to the geopolitical situation in East Asia. And it did change things, because before Zheng He arrived, there were a few other envoys were sent out before Zheng He ever went. But they'd be sent out on, they'd have two or three ships. It would be a smaller venture, just getting in touch with coastal polities around on the east side of the Indian Ocean to say, Emperor Yongle is now the emperor, he should be acknowledged. And so
kind of paving the way. It's an interesting point, because if someone with 30,000 people turns up off your shoreline, that could be pretty frightening. But I suppose they needed to have at least some kind of heads up that this guy was coming.
Yes. And it was pretty frightening, because and that was the intention, because although Emperor Yongle was Chinese and he was ruling a Chinese dynasty, the way he understood rulership was very much in the Mongol style, in the style of Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan. And he wanted to be recognized that way. So these voyages were intended to intimidate, intimidate to the point that there wasn't going to be any resistance to whatever it was that was suggested. Now, they didn't go in and say, you have to do this or that. If the local ruler, and the local rulers were pretty savvy, because by this point, there were already Muslim rajas who had situated themselves in many of the ports of the Indian Ocean. Locally, it was understood if there is a major embassy from China arriving in 48 ships, you're going to go along with them. You're not going to try and resist them. And the famous case of resistance is when the king of Ceylon decides, no, I am not going to submit myself to the Emperor of China. And this leads to a long struggle, a violent struggle. The king is and his family are taken hostage. They're taken back to China. He's officially deposed by Emperor Yongle, who then puts one of his junior kinsmen into power. But that guy gets switched once he gets to Ceylon. I mean, it's a complicated geopolitical story. And if I can put it this way, what's bothered me about the stories of Zheng He is that they're all about glorifying maritime expeditions. Well, maritime expeditions are fine, but you have to think about, well, what are they for? They are not necessarily to increase the wealth and understanding between the party sending the expedition and the party receiving the expedition. They can be violent, they can be intimidative, and they can intervene in local politics in ways that are really not conducive to the stability of the regions into which they sail. By the seventh, Zheng He dies.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
On the seventh voyage, and by this point, we're into the 1440s, and then the court just shuts this down. And the court shuts it down because it's so expensive. These voyages are not, they're not voyages of trade. They do engage in trade along the way, but they're diplomatic voyages. So there's a lot of gift giving. They give gifts to the local rulers. The local rulers give gifts to them. They sometimes convert that into supplies for the ships and so forth. But they are not designed to make money, or even really to be self-supporting. And the cost of running these vast expeditions is simply enormous. Arguably, building the seven fleets that go into the Indian Ocean is the factor that strips South China of all of its trees. Famously, it was treed at the end of the 14th century. And by the middle of the 15th century, the trees have just been stripped because they need the wood to build the ships. Yeah. And if you take the perspective of an Indian Ocean, a port state in the Indian Ocean, this is a high level of intimidation, and you have to work with it. You have no choice. But this idea of glorifying what China is doing is really cheering for empires over smaller states, and it's not something I like to do. So.
Mm. No, a fascinating way of looking at it. Talking about the sheer expense of it and also the number of people, the 30,000 mm-hmm. you mentioned, that obviously must say a great deal about the stability, the internal stability of China when this is going on. So is it fair to see China as a very stable state while these explorations are happening?
Well, it's interesting that you put the question that way. It's a good question. But in fact, when Emperor Yongle came to the throne, there was profound instability because he seizes the throne. He murders his nephew because he wants to seize power. He's the son of the dynastic founder, founds the Ming dynasty in 1368. When he dies, he appoints a grandson to succeed him. And then one of the uncles, Yongle, gets in there and said, no way, raises an army. Marches down to the palace, burns the palace to the ground, and the nephew is never seen again, and he becomes the new emperor. And he reigns with an iron fist. So any officials who express loyalty to the emperor that he had assassinated are immediately executed. So it's politically an extremely unstable time. And part of the logic of sending these fleets out to the world is to get the world to confirm that Yongle is in fact heaven's choice as the emperor of China. If you can't convince your own people that you deserve to be the ruler, then if you get a line of ambassadors from all over the world saying, we come here to honor Emperor Yongle, it helps him with his attempt to create a legitimacy for his resistance. It's an extremely unstable period. Now, in other ways, it's a fairly good period for China. The first half of the 15th century is one of the in climate terms, it's one of the most it's one of the gentlest periods of the Ming dynasty. Temperatures are normal, rainfall is higher than usual, so the crops are abundant. The economy is reasonably healthy through the years of Emperor Yongle's reign, which allows him to do this. And then he has a superb imperial household organization that makes happen what he wants to happen. So he's got a firm grip on the country, a firm grip on the administration. And if he wants to send a fleet of 48 ships to the Indian Ocean, there's no one to say any different. And politically, it's successful. Although once Emperor Yongle has died, the enthusiasm for this sort of thing just drains away because it's too expensive, it's too much, it's the use of too much resources, and there is this sort of sense of political destabilization under the surface that I think alarms the Confucian bureaucrats. So. So frankly, if China in the middle of the 15th century needs to worry about anything, it's not the Indian Ocean, it's the Mongols. The Mongols are a consistent threat to China through this period. And if China is going to focus its resources and its military capacity, it has to be up to the north and the west where the Mongol threat lurks, not out into the maritime zone.
The number of different expeditions I find fascinating as well. The fact there were so many of them. Are they going to the same places?
Yes, they are, and to some extent they are. And in a sense, it's a it's a courier service, because if you go to the port,
Malacca, I don't know.
Malacca. If you go to Malacca and you invite the king of Malacca to come to the capital in China, you have to take him home. So they go in a fairly regular rhythm of every 3 or 4 years in order to take heads of state and their ambassadors back, and then pick up a new round of heads of state and ambassadors who will come to China and acknowledge Emperor Yongle. So he's setting up this sort of taxi service almost for political envoys to go back and forth between China and the Indian Ocean world.
It's interesting, they're not diplomats, they're actually the heads of state.
In some cases, the heads of state, in most cases, they're ambassadors. They're not the heads of state. But sometimes, if you're a head of state, Malacca is a good example of how the decision gets made about whether a head of state goes to China or not. The king of Malacca had recently established himself there. He was from a royal family in another state, and he'd been defeated and kicked out, ended up in Malacca, established a new state there. He needed the backing of China to convince his competitors that he was a major contender and they shouldn't mess with him. So, in fact, he goes to China, meets the emperor, is blessed by the emperor, is sent back, and then he uses his connection to China in order to withstand threats that are coming at him from other areas. The problem, though, is that if you're a king of a smaller state and you leave, you could be away for 2 or 3 years, and during that period of time, you could be deposed. So it's not wise to go and see the emperor of China unless you really need his political backing. Yeah. So what's happening here is that there's this complex political background going on to these voyages. The voyages are not just, this is not sort of China's version of Christopher Columbus or anything like that. It's a completely different situation. And one of the reasons that I think that everyone got so excited about the Zheng He voyages 30 years ago was that Columbus was largely seen as the Europe's ticket to imperial greatness. And it was giving China the same sort of thing. The fact that they were in ships, that's what they had in common. But the challenges European navigators faced, sailing out up and down the Atlantic Ocean, going the distances and covering the latitudes they covered, that required technological breakthroughs and navigational breakthroughs that China never made, and that by making them, that made Europe a more powerful sea power than China was.
Oh, that's fascinating. And when working to try and unpick all of this, are there decent non-Chinese sources which explain what's going on? Or are we all sort of having to unpick it from the Chinese perspective?
We pretty much have to use the Chinese sources. In the book that I published a couple of years ago, Great State, I have a chapter devoted to Zheng He's voyage to Sri Lanka. And there I was able to find local popular stories that recounted Zheng He's time on Sri Lanka in a way that looks completely different from what it says in the official court diary. Because when Zheng He got home, he had to report to the emperor exactly what he had done. But it turns out that what Zheng He reported and what ended up in the Chinese sources was not necessarily what actually happened on the ground. We don't have a lot of those sources. There's not, South Asia is not a great source of written sources prior to about the 16th century. We have some folk tales mostly. It's when the Portuguese come into the Indian Ocean, and that's not until the 16th century, that we begin to get better European documentation about what went on. And Europeans hear about the Zheng He voyages. But by and large, we're restricted by the Chinese sources, which which are useful and informative, but you have to read them against the grain because they're very much tied up with the political legitimacy of Emperor Yongle. So it makes it difficult to really get to the bottom of what the experience of those voyages was like.
Yeah. Does archaeology help?
Archaeology can help. There haven't been many, I should be able to give you a better answer to this.
Oh, no, they found a rudder from a treasure ship, haven't they, in Nanjing?
They found a few bits and pieces, but they haven't found one of the ships.
No.
And largely, these ships didn't go down. And so when a ship got back, it would be partly dismantled, rebuilt for the next voyage. So we don't have the archaeological finds that we have for example, any of the for the Spanish galleons that are going across the Pacific. We've got a couple of those, and those help tremendously in understanding what the ship was like, what the ship carried, and all that sort of thing. And we don't have that for the Zheng He voyages.
What do you think about the way China today looks back on this period in the past and perhaps uses it? I'm thinking about the way they are focusing so much on the Belt and the Road Initiative and everything.
Yes.
And in using their history. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that the current government in China needs a narrative to tell Chinese, but also to tell the world about China's place in the world. And they want to get away from the old image of China sort of enclosed behind the Great Wall, a continental world that is not a maritime world. They want to change that story. And the Zheng He expeditions are full of great stories and great characters. And that becomes a kind of it's a narrative that the government can use to say, well, we've had relations with Sri Lanka since before the 15th century. Mm-hmm. And
places so like Cambodia as well, that matters, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, and that too. So China is now back out in the world where it had once been. I think there's a rather high measure of cynicism in all of this, because as I've suggested earlier in my remarks, their arrival in Sri Lanka in the 15th century was not welcomed. It was resisted. It was violent. And that's all, of course, just swept under the rug. And we instead have this happy story about how the Chinese and the Sri Lankans have had cordial relations for five centuries. Which really isn't the case at all. But so these are political stories that are worked up to try and make China appear to be doing what it should be doing. That is, it's not China trying to be a Western power. It's China reimagining itself as what it had previously been. So it's largely political tale telling rather than anything. There's nothing of substance there, really. It's all been manufactured in the last 15, 20 years as a way to try and make China visible to the world and comprehensible to the world, and in a sense a natural part of the maritime world that we inhabit.
Yeah, well, fascinating. Tim, thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Well, Sam, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your interest in China's history in this regard.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, there's so much more coming your way, and next up is an episode on what the shipwrecks of Southeast Asia can tell us about this fascinating period of Chinese international trade and expansion in the Middle Ages. In the meantime, please do check out our YouTube channel, which is great fun and full of videos that will change the way that you think about the maritime past, I promise you. And do please leave us a rating and review however you are listening to our podcast, but especially if you're listening on iTunes or listening on an iPhone. This podcast comes from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research, so please do check out what both of those wonderful institutions are up to. In particular, please Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature. It's the Lloyd's Register Foundation's latest project, filming the world's best ship models with the very latest camera equipment. I've just returned from the International Maritime Organization's headquarters in London, filming their ship models, and the results are going to be absolutely spectacular, but you can see everything that's already been published. The Society for Nautical Research you can find at snr.org.uk, and please sign up and join. It's a brilliant way of supporting maritime history. It's a brilliant way of meeting, and it's just brilliant, full stop.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.